Just a heads up for this episode that there are some quite graphic and upsetting accounts of violence against children and one reference to sexual violence. So please take care, and if this is something that you're sensitive to, I'd advise skipping over to the second half of the episode. During the period known as the Troubles in Northern Ireland, the death toll was quite significant. The figure generally accepted is 3,532, which consisted of British soldiers, paramilitaries, and civilians. Over half the people killed during the Troubles were civilians, and of those civilians, it's generally considered that 186 of those killed were children. This episode is an attempt to give you an insight into the life of a child during the Troubles, and the dangers that they faced on a daily basis. This is the Troubles Podcast, a podcast which explores the violence and bloodshed that occurred in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Great Britain, as multiple sides and organisations waged a bloody conflict over the status of Northern Ireland. This episode will be a bit different from regular ones, as the second half of the episode will heavily feature my interview with Richard Moore, who was blinded at the age of 10 when he was struck in the face by a rubber bullet fired by the British Army in 1972. I'll also be referencing the documentary Children in Crossfire, which is a 1974 documentary produced by the BBC, which is a wonderful insight into childhood during the Troubles. That being said, it has its own issues, which I'll address later. Another excellent and harrowing source I'll be using for the first half of this episode is a book called Children of the Troubles, which chronicles each and every child killed in the conflict. It's written by Joe Duffy and Frey McClements, and it would take days to go through the entire list, so in this episode I've selected a few to give an insight into the many lives lost.
Of Belfast in the dark of early morn, British soldiers came marauding, wrecking little homes in scorn, heedless of the crying children, dragging fathers from their beds, beating sons while helpless mothers watched the blood pour from their head.
Armoured cars and tanks and guns came to take away our sons, but every man will stand behind them and behind the wire.
Not for them the judge and jury, nor indeed a crime at all, be when Irish means we're guilty, so we're guilty one and all. Round the world in three lotecos, Cromwell's men are here again, England's name again a solver in the eyes of honest men.
Armoured cars and tanks and guns came to take away our sons, but every man will stand behind the men behind the wire.
It was 1969 in Northern Ireland, and after a gradual escalation of violence, the British Army arrived on August 14th. Shortly after their arrival, 9-year-old Patrick Rooney would become the first child casualty of the Troubles. He lived with his family in Divis Flats in Belfast. I've spoken about Divis Flats before. It's where Jean McConville lived before she was forcibly disappeared. Divis Flats would go on to become a hub of Republican activity, and the many civilian families living there would often find themselves trapped in the crossfire of the IRA and the security forces. It was August 15th, 1969, and there was intense fighting happening on the streets of Belfast, with the Northern Irish Police Force, the RUC, firing tracer rounds, which lit up as they streaked across the city. The Rooney family gathered together in one room, terrified that their apartment would be struck. The parents, Alice and Neely, thought about escaping but felt it was too dangerous to go outside. 9-year-old Patrick was going upstairs to his bed after staying up late to watch a horror movie. As Alice reached to get a coat for Patrick's brother, she felt a bullet graze her cheek. Patrick then slid down the wall. Alice initially thought that he fainted, but when she picked him up, she saw that there was blood coming out of the back of his head. He'd been struck by a stray bullet from a machine gun which was mounted on an RUC armoured car. The bullet had gone through the wall and into the home of the Rooneys and killed Patrick. Patrick may have been the first, but he was by no means the last. Even on that very same night, in another part of Belfast, 15-year-old Gerard McCauley was shot and killed by loyalist gunmen as he helped people who had been burned out of their homes. Gerard was a member of the FINA, who were the youth wing of the IRA. This is a point that also should be mentioned. Many children got wrapped up in paramilitary activity at a very young age, by joining youth wings and then progressing up to full-on paramilitary activity. For many young boys in Northern Ireland, the Fianna were like the Boy Scouts. Their friends were involved and they wanted to be involved too. That same year, Tony Lewis was a 16-year-old boy from West Belfast who was killed along with three other young men when a bomb that they were assembling accidentally detonated, causing massive amounts of damage where they were on Clonard Street. There was also Bernard Fox, who was a member of the Fianna who exuded leadership qualities and was appointed Operational Commander, or OC, at the age of 16. Bernard was killed during a firefight between the IRA and the British Army. His family had no idea he had anything to do with paramilitary activity, until Republicans approached them and asked if they wanted Bernard to have a military funeral. This is also something that should be noted. In many cases, family members had no idea that their children were involved in paramilitary activity. In some households, both a son and a father could be involved in paramilitary groups and never know about the other. Such was the nature of the secrecy in involvement. Or rather, they would know but never talk about the other's involvement, which would help if one of them was picked up by the security forces. Advertisements would eventually run in papers warning parents to be vigilant of their children, saying, quote, "The worry is yours, the sentence is theirs. Save tears, save time, check on your children." There were other projects aimed at children in Northern Ireland too. Project Children was founded in 1975 and took children out of Northern Ireland and over to host families in the USA, where they could spend their summers experiencing the life of regular children. 10-year-old Stephen Geddes was one such child who took part in this programme, spending 6 months in South Dakota in 1975, where he learned to ride horses. Upon returning to Northern Ireland, Stephen was distraught and wanted to go back to the USA. He was also teased for his American accent, which he had developed while over there. Stephen was walking along a street, eating a lollipop, when he was struck in the head at point-blank range by a plastic bullet fired by the British Army. Stephen died in hospital 2 days later. The British Army claimed that they had been using the rounds to disperse a crowd who were throwing stones, but an inquest later found that Stephen was not involved in the stone throwing and was playing innocently with his friends when he was struck. 16-year-old Kieran Nugent was walking his dog with his friend Bernard McErlean when a car pulled up beside them and a machine gun began firing, killing Bernard. Shortly after this, Kieran joined the IRA. A different Bernard, Bernard Teggart, was a 15-year-old boy with a mental age of 9 who was walking home from school one day when he saw a drinks lorry being held up, presumably by the IRA. The driver was being held at gunpoint and Bernard said to the gunman, quote, "Mister, leave that man alone." For this reason, he was abducted and then shot in the back of the head and dumped, with a cardboard placard bearing the word tout strung around his neck. One of the most disturbing deaths that I came across while researching this episode was that of 14-year-old David McLennigan. David had an intellectual disability, and his mother, Sally, was a Catholic who married a Protestant. By July 1972, they were amongst the only Catholics left on their street, and it was for this reason that they were targeted. Four loyalists broke into their house. They allowed Sally's partner to leave once he produced an orange sash, proving that he was a Protestant. They then told David to get his mother's rosary beads. Sally tried to get him to stay put, but David didn't understand and went to get her handbag. The men searched Sally's handbag and found rosary beads, proving that she was a Catholic. They then bet David and raped Sally before shooting David in the neck and chest, killing him. Four men were eventually arrested and given hefty sentences for this. One of the men present that night was Trevor Hilton, who denied raping Sally and killing David, but said of the night, quote, "It was a stupid, drunken escapade that should never have happened. I tried to take my life because I couldn't live with it." Trevor was released from prison in 1989, but then was involved in a hatchet attack on a Catholic man and sent back again until 2002. Upon release, he became deeply religious and claimed that God had forgiven him for his actions. But the killing of children didn't just happen in Northern Ireland. Naruti Islania was a 6-month-old baby who lived on an RAF base in the west of Germany. In 1989, Her father Mick was stationed there, and for that reason Mick and his family were targeted. Naruti was in the back of her parents' car as they were stopping to get food, when two IRA gunmen emerged and opened fire on the occupants of the car. Though they were targeting Mick, they ended up killing both Mick and Naruti. Naruti's mother, Smitha, was also in the car but was uninjured and cradled her dead baby in her arms as her husband lay dead in the car beside her. The IRA later apologised for killing baby Naruti, saying that they were unaware that she was in the car. I'm going to take a quick step back now and just talk about the use of rubber and plastic bullets, because they played a very prominent role throughout the Troubles. The British Army first started using batten rounds in Northern Ireland in 1970. This was the first time they were used anywhere in the world, and they were intended to be a non-lethal way of riot control. The original batten rounds were developed by Hong Kong police in the 1960s and made from teak wood. They were deemed too dangerous for use in Northern Ireland, so rubber bullets were created and then unveiled. They packed an incredibly powerful punch and were designed to be bounced off the ground before hitting their targets. But the bouncy nature of the rubber meant that the trajectory of the bullets was unpredictable. I came across some sources that said that the British Army was actually aware how lethal these rounds could be, and hoped that the name rubber bullets would sound less offensive. Rubber bullets was then replaced by plastic bullets, which were referred to as plastic rounds, so as to sound less dangerous than the word bullet. But the plastic rounds proved to be even more deadly than the rubber ones. Both rubber and plastic bullets were far from non-lethal and caused some devastating injuries to many during the Troubles. In 1972, 11-year-old Francis Rowntree was playing with some friends in Divis Flats when he saw a British Army vehicle nearby. He went to look at the vehicle and was struck in the head with a rubber bullet, killing him. Francis was the first person to be killed by a rubber bullet during the Troubles. The Army then claimed that he had been involved in throwing stones, but an inquest into his death in 2017 said that they were confident that he was not involved in the rioting. His mother went on to become a campaigner against the use of rubber bullets. Just 7 days after Francis, another child would lose their life. 8-year-old Rosaline Gavin was shot in the head as she was running home from the shop after buying her mother cigarettes. The IRA initially claimed that she was killed by loyalists, but it later emerged that she was accidentally shot by an IRA sniper who had been shooting at British soldiers in the area. The children who lost their lives during the Troubles did so in a number of different and equally tragic ways. Some were playing outside when they were struck by British Army vehicles. Others were caught in a crossfire and hit by a stray bullet. Some children even found a gun hidden by a paramilitary and lost their lives playing with it. There are also some who were involved in paramilitary activity and died in gunfights or from accidental detonations while assembling bombs. Some were deliberately targeted and gunned down because of their religion. And some were just going about their daily lives when they were in the wrong place in the wrong time and a bomb would detonate. At least 8 children were killed as a result of rubber bullets. There are many, many tragic stories. The rest of this episode will focus on one specific person who at the age of 10 was left permanently blinded after he was struck in the face with a rubber bullet. I sat down and had a chat with Richard Moore about his life growing up in Derry in the 70s, and it's at this point I'm going to take a bit of a back seat and let Richard tell his story. He lived in an estate known as the Craigan in the city of Derry.
And back in the 60s, the Craigan was a very nice and pleasant place to live for a young boy. My parents were basically unemployed. My father was an unemployed shoemaker. My mother was what you would describe nowadays as a homemaker. And there were 12 children in the house, 9 boys and 3 girls. So, you know, she was kept busy making a home and that. But at a very warm, loving, friendly home, and really never wanted for anything. But Craigan on the Bogside, really around 1968, 69, became like a war zone. What I felt like it was an overnight change. You know, one day you're out playing football with your friends and, you know, and doing all the normal things that children do. And the next thing, you know, you're seeing the men of the neighborhood driving hijacked vehicles, ripping up the pavements, setting vehicles on fire, and then riots and bombings, become a daily occurrence. Now, I'm sure it didn't happen overnight, but looking back on it, to me, it feels like it happened overnight.
When it came to the British soldiers, Richard explained that a child at the age of 9 or 10, seeing them was an incredibly exciting experience.
I remember the odd occasion you would see like an army foot patrol coming walking down through the Craigan, and you would think, you know, this is unbelievable, an actual live army. And the guys maybe would be sitting in the grass or kneeling down beside a house or, you know, taking up positions of, you know, being protective or whatever, and you'd see them in their helmets and their flak jackets and their rifles and all that. And to a young boy, it was completely and utterly awesome. Aye, and I have to say, it's probably more exciting than it was terrifying, and I'm being honest at that time. You know, we just, you know, I never felt in any danger. I never felt that I was at risk. I just felt that, wow, look at this, you know, there's a guy down there with a gun. And if somebody came up and says, there's an IRA checkpoint down there, everybody would have ran down towards it. It's not like you ran away from it.
One source that I used while researching this episode was the documentary Children in Crossfire, which I'll leave a link to in the show notes. The documentary shows how the Troubles deeply affected children and left some terrified to even leave their homes. Children as young as 4 or 5 would paint pictures of tanks and soldiers in school. In the documentary, you can see footage of Richard as a child and his friends in the Craigan. It's important to note that while this documentary is an excellent source showing footage from the period, it would also be considered quite a biased source, and in some cases depicts the children as agitators or delinquents. Richard explained how he felt about its portrayal of him and his friends.
In that documentary in particular, it's Children in Crossfire, believe it or not, and that was recorded back in 1974, and it did come under a lot of criticism from the local community. I know people weren't pleased by the way it, you know, by the slant that it took, by the way in which the children were kind of set up to look, you know, and it sort of kind of portrayed us all as young terrorists in training. And if you ask children to go down and riot so that you can film them, then to me that's not an authentic situation.
Daily life for Richard and his family was fairly normal. I asked him if he ever felt threatened by the violence that was happening around them.
I think there was a kind of an acknowledgement or a sense that, you know, that anything that would happen wouldn't really turn in on us. If there was a bomb scare, then, you know, maybe, especially in our area, then it probably generally would have been safe enough. Now, obviously, that things like that didn't happen, and people were killed by bombs and stuff like that. But generally, there was, you know, if you're aware of a bomb scare, then you would have been, you know, had to vacate the area, and, you know. And the only thing that I think would have worried your parents is when you had the impromptu, say, gun battles and stuff like that, where, you know, maybe the IRA would open fire on the military. And there were, you know, sometimes you knew when that was going to happen because of maybe a buildup of something or other. Like, for example, Poland Day. Every election, you know, the school, my old school, was used as a polling booth. And when the police or the army would come in to collect, you know, pick up the polling boxes at the end of the day, then it was a time when, you know, the IRA would have maybe planned an attack.
Growing up, Richard explained that many children saw the IRA in a romantic light.
You know, there was always a potential that people were attracted to paramilitaries, and, you know, because there was a bit of a kind of a romance around it in a way.
Yeah,
there was a macho-ness around it. And, you know, like, you know, when we would have, even as children, played, you know, in every other part of the world, children would have played cowboys and Indians. We played IRA men and British soldiers. And everybody wanted to be an IRA man. Nobody wanted to be a British soldier. So that's how we viewed it. At that particular point in time, like back in the early 70s.
One of the most important moments in the history of the Troubles was Bloody Sunday, which I covered back in Season 1, which saw members of the British Army open fire into an unarmed crowd, shooting dead a number of civilians. Richard was just 10 years old, but still vividly remembers the events of that day.
It's probably one of those days that became, it was a normal day, and you probably wouldn't remember anything about Bloody Sunday, only as a result of what happened, then every detail almost stays with you. And like, I can remember, it was a Sunday sort of midday-ish, you know, lunchtime-ish, and out playing football in the street and watching all the men and women make their way to Bishop's Field and the Craigan, where the march was kicking off from. I can remember the conversations in our house about who's going to march today, and are you going to march today, and all that. And, you know, and then I can recall being down at the end of our street, in a street called Broadway, believe it or not. And we were down there, you know, just moved about at different times. And I can remember watching the people returning home from the march. And I can remember all the serious faces in that. And then I saw one man with tears in his eyes. And I remember thinking that it was probably the CS gas that caused the tears. But subsequently I discovered it was because of what he witnessed. And I heard him saying to somebody, there's murder down there. And so that was my first knowledge that something had gone south really with that. And then later on that evening, I was on the street with my friends, and I saw my Uncle Willie leaving our house. Arriving at our house. My Uncle Willie arriving at the house. And my Uncle Willie lived in Donegal. And it was very unusual for him to come in at that time of the night. Normally, they would come in sort of like a set visit to our house from Donegal. It was a bit of a journey in those days. And, you know, it would have been like, your Uncle Willie's arriving today, and, you know, we would all be up to see him and all that sort of stuff. Whereas this was a visit that, you know, he was arriving late at night. And then I saw my brother Liam leaving our house. And again, Liam was married and living out of the house at that stage. But, you know, he drove a car. We didn't have a car in the family, and my brother Liam had a car. So it was always like he would have been waving at you or winding down the window to talk to you or being sociable. Whereas this particular day, I saw him literally run out of our house and run into the car, and he looked very serious. So those things I remember clearly. And then I eventually went home, went into the house. Obviously, it was coming close to bedtime, maybe 7 o'clock or half seven at night or whatever, as a young boy. And I went into the house, and my mammy was sitting in our living room, and she was crying. And the TV was on, the room was silent. And my mammy said, your Uncle Gerard was killed today. And at that stage, you know, you were sitting on the sofa, you saw the news bulletins coming in telling you that there were 5 people killed, there were 8 people killed at the march in Derry, and our house was completely silent. And I know that some of the boys hadn't returned home, my older brothers, and, you know, my mammy and them were watching the door constantly till everybody come in. So, and then of course, my Uncle Gerard was shot dead on Bloody Sunday. So I can remember going to the wake and seeing my Aunt Ida, and she was completely distraught. And like, she was a young mother in her, you know, mid-30s. She had 8 children and was expecting her 9th. And the 9th child was born 3 weeks after Bloody Sunday. And you know, and then I remember one of the starkest memories. Well, God, there's so many, Oisin, you know, like, my brother took me for a run in the car down around the bogside the day after Bloody Sunday. And I can remember seeing all the places where people had been shot, because there was all these pools of congealed blood. I remember seeing the civil rights banner lying on a pool of blood. Jeez. I can remember going into the Craigan Chapel. And again, it was shocking. You see, if, you know, anybody gets into a chapel, you would saw maybe one coffin of somebody who passed away. There were 13 coffins in the chapel. lined across the altar. And it was just an unbelievable thing to see 13 coffins all at once in a chapel. You know, sometimes I think, Oisin, you know what happens? Part of you remains a child, but part of you grows up.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I went to my aunt, my Uncle Jared's funeral, and I saw my aunt. I'd have been carried shoulder high away from the cemetery, being distraught. And like, the thoughts that you have then are not the thoughts of a child.
Yeah.
What you're seeing there is not something a child should see. And I think, though, there is a part of you that suddenly grows up. And then there's a part of you that'll still be that child that'll go and play a game of football.
Just 4 months later, on the 4th of May, 1972, Richard's life would be forever changed. I'll hand it over to Richard to tell the whole story.
I was just 10 years of age. I went to the local primary school. It was on the edge of the Craigan estate. It was right beside a police station. And Craigan, as we already talked about, was, you know, a no-go area or barricades. It was, you know, a violent place in many ways. And this police station, because of where it was located, at the edge of a no-go area, was a target for the IRA and that. And then the British Army were brought in to protect this police station. And one of the army lookout posts protecting that police station was faced into the school football pitch. And if you visualize the area, I mean, there was a row of terrace houses that faced out onto the road, but the back of those houses backed onto the school football pitch.
Okay.
But there was a gap in between the houses that would have let you through to the police station. And so the military filled that gap with an army lookout post that went from wall to wall, and you couldn't see into it. The army looked out through a kind of a porthole, you might say. But this hut was built to protect the soldiers against bombs and bullets. So it was had barbed wire in front of it.
Very fortified.
Corrugated iron. Yeah, very fortified. That's actually the best way to describe it. And so you couldn't see into it at all. And so we used to shout at it, things like that, as kids would do, you know. And but you never knew even if there were anybody in there, because they didn't even react. It's not like even shouted back out at you or anything.
Yeah.
The military didn't even react. About 3 months after Bloody Sunday, the 4th of May, 1972. In fact, it's only next week will be my, I think, 49th anniversary.
Wow.
You know, I was running along the pitch and a British soldier fired a rubber bullet that hit me in the bridge of the nose. And I lost my right eye and my left eye was permanently blinded. So I can remember, I woke up and I was lying on the school canteen table where my music teacher, Mr. Giles Doherty, he heard the bang and he ran over and lifted me, found me lying on the ground, and he carried me over and put me on the school canteen table. And I remember him saying to me, "What's your name, son?" And I told him my name was Richard Moore. And he got a bit of a shock because he knew me very well. I was in his music class, but because of the extent of the injuries, my nose was completely flattened. My eyeballs were down at my cheekbones.
Jesus.
And my face was just a bloody mess. So when I went to hospital, initially they thought I was going to die from the injuries. Then they thought I was going to have brain damage. And then finally, they told my parents that I would be blind for the rest of my life. So it was a pretty serious injury. Like, it was touch and go for about a week, whether I would live or not, you know. The army basically, took the stance that I was a young hoodlum.
Okay.
They described me as, I think. They said I was a rioter, and more or less said that what happened, I brought on to myself. Now, the reality is, I wasn't a rioter. I was on a school playground. There was no pedestrian pass through there. It was a playground that was surrounded by the school, and backed these houses backed on it. There was no pedestrians walk through there. There was no public access other than children and the teachers. So they suggest that there was a riot. It's just bizarre because, you know, the teachers knew there was an army lookout post facing on the school playground. So they knew they keep a vigilance around that area when the children were going home.
Yeah, absolutely.
Make sure that nothing silly happened. So we would have been shooed along in that. And it didn't mean we didn't shout at the army or whatever. You know, of course we did. Hopefully get away with it before the teacher would catch you shouting.
It's not kind of the thuggery sort of rioter that they were trying to convey.
And I was probably the oldest there. I was 10 years of age. Now, there was an older school there that got out after ours, but I was probably the oldest there. But listen, that's what the military did in those days, you know, get first strike, you know, blame the victim and take it from there. And, and that position never really changed right down through the years, you know, that's the stance they had. I think there's a lot of questions need to be asked. I believe the rubber bullet was fired that day carelessly. I think it was unlawful. I think it was irresponsible. And, you know, I think it was, you know, something that just shouldn't have happened. Now, you know, what leads somebody to think that it's all right to do that? I think the British soldier is responsible for firing the rubber bullet.
Yeah.
But I also think that there's a wider responsibility. And, you know, when you have a society and a culture behind those soldiers, telling them that whatever you do is fine, whatever you do is okay, then, you know, you have to question what leads a person to think that it's all right to do that. What leads a highly trained, fully disciplined British soldier to fire a rubber bullet into a school playground at a group of children and think that it's all right? You know, so that I think we have to question, obviously, the soldier, but you need to question the society that supports that activity.
Yeah, that was making the calls.
And gives that license to behave in the way they behave. Yes, I did adjust to being blind, and I bounced back very quickly the blindness, and have continued to be, almost see blindness in a positive light and not always entirely in a negative light. Did I adjust quickly? I think I did adjust reasonably quickly, but there were challenges. And at the time, I always think there's two sides to blindness. There's the emotional side and there's the physical side. So the physical side was being able to move about freely and all that. And, you know, thanks to my friends, to the local community, to my family, then, you know, they were really supportive. And, you know, there was always somebody about to guide me around and they include me in things and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, you used to go cycling, didn't you?
I used to go on a bicycle and my friends used to run in front of me shouting directions. You can imagine how that went after a while. They were exhausted.
I can't imagine that ended well, but well, who knows?
It ended all right. But I mean, the problem was that, you know, I was cycling at a certain speed and they were trying to run ahead of me and it became pretty exhausting. But I mean, you know, I did try to mix in the best I could. So there's that physical side of it. And then there's the emotional side of it. And, you know, there were times that I must not be able to play football the way I used to play football.
Richard never felt any hatred towards the British soldiers in general. I asked him how he managed to turn away from hate after experiencing such a significant life-altering event.
I don't know, Oisin. I mean, I don't remember having any hatred whatsoever. And, you know, if I had met a British soldier in the street, I would have been friendly with him. And I think that it had to do with my parents. because I know that they never spoke in an angry way about what happened. And in fact, they would have said the opposite. My parents were two very devout Catholics, Oisin. You know, they went to Mass every day of their lives. They were just so loving and caring, and they had an enormous faith. And, you know, my mammy prayed all the time, my daddy prayed all the time. You know, but they didn't bit it into your, they weren't Bible punchers in the house or not. But they used to sort of say, look, you know, it's important that you say your prayers. It's important that you go to Mass. It's important that you, you know, that you keep God in your life type of thing. And that was that really. Their witness was just how they lived their life, really. So, you know, now they were brokenhearted with what happened to me. I mean, my mammy basically had a mental breakdown after I was shot, though I was never diagnosed, but the more I talk about it and the more I'm aware of it, then I realise my mammy basically, you know, the woman was found walking down through a main street in Derry in the middle of the road. She used to go and sit in the chapel for hours on end, crying and crying. She contemplated suicide. You know, my mammy had all those experiences. And I can remember at night, lying in my bed, and my mammy would come up and she would kneel beside my bed, and she thought I was sleeping. And she would start to say her prayers. And then she would break down and she would start to cry. And she'd be saying things like, God, look at him. He's only a 10-year-old boy. Please give him back his eyesight. And she wouldn't be saying it in a way that I'm saying it now. She was just desperate. So, and my daddy, he was, you know, he was a remarkably strong man, you know. And my daddy, for you know, being an unemployed shoemaker, he was really such an intelligent man and such a practical man. But, you know, when he came back from the hospital, after they told him that I would be blind for the rest of my life, he just stood in the middle of our street and cried for the man out of the street. You know, and I was told long after that my daddy had died, and long after the incident, you know, I wrote an autobiography. And as part of the autobiography, I started to research things and ask questions around the family members and stuff about, because there are a lot of what happened around that time that I wouldn't even be aware of because I was in the eye of the storm.
Yeah.
You know, and when my daddy was in the hospital, the doctors told him that Richard's not going to get his eyesight back, Mr. Murr, or whatever. And my daddy said, can I give him my eyes? Yes. And I just think that that's one of the most incredibly caring and loving and compassionate things that anybody could ever do. All that he could give was his own eyesight. But they had all that hurt, all that pain, but no anger.
Richard remembers at one point his brother arguing with his mother about getting revenge.
It wasn't very long after I was shot, you know, but I was out at home. And my brother was out with my mommy in the kitchen. And he was shouting at her. And he was angry. And he kept saying, or he was saying things like, you know, they murdered my Uncle Jared. They blinded Richard. It's time to give her own back. And I remember my mommy saying, if you want to help Richard, go on there and help Richard. But you're not helping Richard by hurting somebody else. So that was the message. And, you know, when I think of my mommy saying that, how incredible is that? In the middle of her own hurt and pain and mental anguish, she was able to say, you're wrong. The way you're thinking is wrong. So if I have notions of forgiveness, then that's where it comes from. It comes from her. No, I know, and it's nice for me to have those thoughts too, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I owe so much to the both of them for the example that they set for me in my life, you know.
Yeah.
All of that contributes towards my ability to accept blindness, my ability to move on with my life.
When Richard got older, he actually had the chance to meet the soldier who shot him, so I asked him to tell me a little bit about that experience.
The most significant thing that happened to me in my life was being shot and blinded. The person I am, the personality I have, the way my life has evolved, was all dictated by that incident that day. I always say when I was knocked over by the rubber bullet, I was knocked on a journey. And the other person that was involved in that experience was a soldier. So I often wondered about him. And at times it was like looking into a shadow. You know, you knew there was somebody there, but you didn't know anything about them.
Yeah.
So I built up this image over the years that the soldier was 18 years of age. He was on an army lookout post on the edge of a no-go area. He was probably crapping himself, you know, frightened, you know, dangerous area to be in. But I always said to some people, and I had no anger as you read this course, so I wanted to meet the guy. I wanted to meet him out of curiosity, and I also wanted to meet him to let him know that I forgive. And I said it many occasions. I would have done chats like this. I would have been on the newspapers or TV or whatever, and I would have always said, I'd love to meet the soldier someday. But to be honest with you, I thought I would never meet him.
Yeah.
Because it was too sort of closed down.
Yeah, and the British Army are quite secretive as well. It's sometimes
exactly.
It's to find.
Security yeah. issues and all that. But eventually, this crowd in Belfast were making a documentary about my story. But they were making it for the BBC. It was called Blind Vision. And we were in a peace process. Things began to relax. And they were able to track down the soldier. So ultimately, I wrote a letter to the soldier. I didn't know his name at that stage. And they hand-delivered it to him. And 3 weeks later, the soldier responded to my letter. And then in my letter, I asked him, would he be willing to meet? And when he responded, he said he would. So then we arranged to meet in Scotland. And it was fantastic. It was an amazing experience, you know.
The soldier ended up not being exactly as Richard imagined. His name was Charles Innes, and he was 30 years old and a captain in the British Army at the time.
When I received the letter from him and I realised that he was in his 30s when he shot me, he was a captain in the Army. And so that whole image that I had for 33 years was turned on its head. And that did take a bit of mental adjustment for me because I did get a bit of a shock in that one. So, you know, we met in a hotel foyer in Scotland, and it was an amazing day. It really was. And I suppose I would say that I learned two things about forgiveness that day. The first thing is forgiveness is a gift that you give to yourself. And what I mean by that is, you know, that, you know, forget about charge, forget about anything else. Forgiveness is about you and about you fighting freedom, about you releasing yourself to be happy. And then the second thing is forgiveness doesn't change the past, but it does change the future. And again, I reflect on that quite often, and I try to say to people, look, the fact that I forgive Charles isn't going to give me eyesight back, isn't going to take away the hurts that were caused. But what forgiveness does do and has done is change your future and, you know, helps you to move on.
Yeah.
And, you know, all of that stuff to me was incredible. And then just to get to know him and get to chat with him, you know, and you know, I wasn't a soldier anymore. And the thing, you know,
yeah,
you realize is,
yeah,
becomes a human being. Well, I asked Charles that he deliberately aimed the bullet at me. And he said, no. He said, Richard, I didn't even see you.
Yeah.
So, in his view, rubber bullets didn't cause any damage. Now, you know and I know that that's not true. And I often wonder how Charles would even think that. But the bottom line is, that's what he says. And
yeah.
You know, I either accept it or I don't. And, you know, he fired. There's nothing in his terms of engagement that permit what Charles did that.
Absolutely. There's nothing that says.
But
10-year-old child.
It's,
yeah,
it's okay to fire rubber bullets randomly. That if you don't even see somebody, that just fired anyway.
Though Richard and Charles became friends, it was still a number of years before Charles apologised.
For 6 years that I knew Charles, if you had asked him, and I mean, me and him are good friends and remain good friends and still good friends, but if you had asked him during that first 6 years, do you apologise? Or did you say sorry? He'd have said, no, I didn't say sorry, nor do I feel I need to apologise. But do you know what? I always knew he was sorry. He just couldn't bring himself to say it for some stupid reason, I think. Some misguided reason, let's say. But eventually, 6 years after, we were on Derry here together, and we're over in a local hotel, and we're chatting, and the sorry question came up. And I said to him, well, Charles, the event we were doing the next day, I said, Charles, you're probably going to be asked the sorry questions tomorrow.
You probably get it a lot.
And he said, Richard, I am sorry. And I thought, wow, you know, because I wasn't expecting it. I never asked him. Sorry was not a condition of my meeting with him. And as a result of that, then, you know, when he said it, I nearly fell off a chair. It was overwhelming because I never asked for it. And I still got it. So what did that tell me? And again, I'm always looking for lessons. And the lesson it taught me is, you know, maybe I was 100 miles down the road in my journey ahead of Charles. And he had to make his journey too. And many people said to me, you know, I wouldn't have met him until he apologized. If I had operated under that sort of those conditions, then Charles would have never made that journey and he would have never have said sorry. So in my reckoning, you know, you should never set preconditions to reconciliation. Because, you know, if you genuinely want to reconcile with somebody, you've got to allow them to be who they are. And they've got to allow you to be who you are. They've got to live in their space, and you've got to live in your space. You don't have to agree as long as you facilitate that.
Yeah,
and in doing that,
as long as there's understanding.
Yeah, and in doing that, what's happening? You're freeing up each other to begin a dialogue.
Though Richard suffered from a life-changing injury as a child, he has gone on to have an incredibly full and rich life. I should say, it hasn't been this way for everyone who was injured during the Troubles, and many have gone on to have many difficulties all throughout their life as a result of what happened 30, 40, 50 years ago. In Richard's case, he went on to get married and have 2 children. He has his own non-profit radio station, he's a musician, and he's even met the Dalai Lama a couple of times, who went on to describe Richard as his inspiration. A mural of Richard and the Dalai Lama was unveiled in early 2021 in the city of Derry. Though in the early 90s, Richard had his own business and was doing quite well, in 1996, he left his job to set up a charity called Children in Crossfire, which is a charity dedicated to helping children who are suffering from poverty around the world.
I did it because I realised that I could be a voice for children that can't speak for themselves. I realised that despite what happened to me, I still was able to go back to school and get an education for myself. I had loads of support from family and community. And I was on the receiving end of so much kindness and generosity. And I just thought, if I could give some of that back, then, and I was able to help one child, then my blindness was worthwhile.
During the COVID lockdown, Richard also started his own podcast called What About You? The first season features one-on-one conversations with those who were affected by the Troubles, and the next season will focus on something completely different. It's a great podcast, and I'll leave a link to it in the show notes. but you can find it anywhere by searching What About You podcast. The actual full interview with Richard is a bit longer than what made it into this episode, so I'll be posting the entire interview on my Patreon page. So if you want to listen to that and help out the podcast, you can do so over at patreon.com/thetroublespodcast. The shadow of the Troubles still hangs over Northern Ireland today, and though time is helping to diminish things, it will be a lot longer before the psychological effects disappear completely. In 2018, a mental health charity concluded that Northern Ireland has a higher prevalence of mental illness than the rest of the United Kingdom, and much of that is directly linked to the Troubles. Northern Ireland also has the highest suicide rate in the United Kingdom. While there is still this collective trauma, there has also been a lot done to heal. And when speaking to people like Richard, I am filled with a hope for the future. That's it for me this week. Thanks, and see you next time.